Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a NIDA conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. NIDA is a National Institute of Drug Abuse, and it traces its history to 1935 with the Small Addiction Research Center in Kentucky. And now it's a $1.7 billion agency with nearly 400 employees and thousands of research investigators. NIDA invests in research for basic neuroscience, epidemiology, risk and protective factors, prevention, treatment, and implementation. The agency provides the gold standard to the world on issues of substance use disorders. To learn more about NIDA's vision for 2025, I reached out to NIDA's director, Dr. Nora Wolkoff. Dr. Nora Wolkoff is the longest residing director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA, which is housed in the National Institute of Health since 2003. She's the world's go-to person when it comes to the issue of drugs. She was named top 100 people that shape our world. She's also the mother of the science that demonstrates that drug addiction is a brain disorder. To learn more about Dr. Nora Wolkoff and NIDA, please visit the High Truth show notes. Dr. Nora Wolkoff, welcome to High Truths.
Dr. Ronet Lev, thanks very much for inviting me.
You're great. What a comedian. You've been doing this for 5 years. I've had this podcast. This is now on the fifth year. Every year you've come and you frame the show for the rest of the year with your data, with what's happening in the drug enforcement field. And I always say, you are the rock star. You're my rock star.
Well, that's you said you were speaking about the comedian. There you have yourself.
No, you. And I said that because many years ago, I was kind of sitting in the front row of the RX Summit and you were speaking. And my daughters texted me. They were at a Justin Bieber concert. And they were like, oh, look, I'm at a concert. I'm seeing a rock. And then I took a picture of you and I sent it to them. I said, no, I'm with the real rock star. So that's great. So I always start, I ask you about yourself, and I've done this for so many times. I thought, okay, what else can I get to know about you more that we haven't really talked about? So you've really have had like a very distinguished career as a leader in addiction medicine and under the National Institute of Health with NIDA. Looking at your career, what is your proudest accomplishment?
It is a difficult one, and you should have asked me that when said, but don't think too much about it, because I think that when we start to think, you start to get these different lines of thinking at the same time. I would say perhaps the thing that I'm most proud is through my research, but also very importantly through my leadership at NIDA, having been able to contribute to the change in the culture that basically has shifted from considering addictions a choice and moral failure to one that really reflects a disorder, a disease condition that has biological underpinnings, but also importantly influenced by our social environments. So I would say that's what I'm most proud of.
Yeah, and we've definitely seen that change in attitude and over the years. And how about looking for, what is your biggest wish?
Well, I think my biggest wish is for these changes to accelerate so that we can shift the patterns of prevention and treatment of substance use disorder across the whole country and providing access to these treatments in an equitable way to everyone. So that would be what I would love to see, that it's not just the advances in science and technologies that influence a few, but actually that we can bring that to everyone that can benefit from them. That's what would be my wish.
Yeah. Universal treatment access to those who need it across the country.
Good quality. Because the issue sometimes we just get ourselves very, very complacent because I said, of course, you have these treatments, but we're not demanding quality treatment. And this is a big challenge that we have in the substance use field, that there are many treatments for which there's absolutely no evidence, and yet they get reimbursed at the same rate as treatments for which there is solid evidence with follow-up for outcomes. I do think that we can still do an enormous amount of work to improve that.
Wow. I think that that's a great goal. You've been through, and this is apropos as we're talking about that, is there's a changing of the guard in the federal administration or with the different presidents. You've survived that many times. What is your key to success for that longevity amidst, you know, changes?
Well, I mean, that notion of that survival, I wouldn't call it that survival, right? Because that is a political administration. But unfortunately, the realities of addiction are a permanent, I say it unfortunate because it's a permanent reality. And in my experience, I have seen the sensitivity to substance use disorder, irrespective of the political beliefs. And it is very much, so it's not so simple as to say, this is a Republican, this is a Democrat, therefore this or therefore that. It does not work like that in substance use disorder. And my view is that if we can communicate the importance of paying attention to this disease, the devastation it has, and the ability to actually use science in order to bring forward better outcomes to everyone, and in the process, everyone benefits, then you can take the community on board, you can take the support and the will to put the resources to make it happen. And in my experience, again, this is not a political issue. This is a healthcare issue with a devastating reality.
Yeah. Now, we can guess, we don't know exactly what the Trump administration will bring to NIDA, NIH, HHS. I know whenever there's changes, any organization, there's nervousness. I don't know if you feel that at NIDA as well. But do you anticipate any changes to the organization because of the change in administration and focus?
Well, it's hard to know, because obviously none of us has the magic ball that tells us what's going to happen. But what I can tell you, and I can anticipate, and I have absolutely no doubt, I mean, in knowing my colleagues at the NIH, in knowing the investment and the involvement of scientists in the field of health, is that the mission is the same. So I'm speaking for the National Institute on Drug Abuse, but we have cancer, we have mental illness, we have obesity and diabetes. And that is an imperative that we all can gravitate towards. I mean, medicine and disease and suffering actually brings us all together. So, and that's a tremendous advantage from the perspective of not having to worry about how someone will react. Everyone has had a family member suffering from a disease, have lost a family member to it. And I would say this is actually true for addiction. We all have been touched by addiction, either directly in our direct family, ourselves, or in close friends. So as a result of that, there is that recognition, and that is what that emotional involvement is what drives a lot of the ability to change things. It's not just the cognitive, rational one that plays a role here. It's the cost that we have when we lose someone to drugs and the whole devastation.
Yeah. You know, the same principle, as you're saying, that applies to, you know, me and my profession as a clinician, as a physician. There have been many changes, right? Insurance plans, CEOs, different management, different billing reimbursements, and you know, and things that have happened. But at the bottom line, the doctor-patient relationship, that doesn't change. People get sick and they need to get healthy and they see a doctor and they you touch people's lives in that way. That doesn't change no matter what the surroundings around you does. So it sounds like a cynical kind of response. I thought of you when it came to, you know, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and their Doge and everybody needing to cut in federal government. And I'm wondering if you were thinking, oh, you know, where can I save money since that seems to be a focus?
Well, independent of the dog initiative, I always think very carefully about the investments because we have a huge responsibility. I mean, at the end of the day, we are the main agencies that has resources that come from taxpayers' dollars for an incredible cause, improve the life of people. So I take it very, very seriously, the notion of being accountable. So if we invest, I want to see the outcomes. And you try to do your best. I mean, sometimes you have to invest on something that you feel has a lot of potential. You do the research and it doesn't pan out. That is typical, but you go with risk that makes sense. So in and of itself, I do feel that it's important that we never become complacent. And that's something that I always communicate to my staff at NIDA. We can be complacent because people are dying. And these are the main resources that we have to advance it. So I take the job very, very seriously and the responsibilities. So as I say, in a way, and people just always criticize me. Oh, Nora, you're an optimist. But the reality is it's sometimes good to be shaken because it forces you to think differently. It forces you to evaluate what you are doing. And if everything is predictable and you know already what's going to happen 5, 10 years from now, or 2 years from now, the motivation is eroded. I mean, our brain needs change in order to sustain the attention. And so in and of itself, I think that it's not a bad thing that we all look inside ourselves with objective, critical eyes and determine how can we do better. And so per se, I mean, obviously, this is at a theoretical level. You want that process to be objective and to have outcomes so that the metrics can be followed. And it doesn't seem to be, it's not arbitrary, which is, again, some of the issues that people may get concerned. And I am also obviously very sensitive to the fact that in some instances, some of those decisions are going to be coming at the loss of jobs for people that depend on that. And that, again, is an issue that we need to take seriously because we have a responsibility. But how do we do it? So it's again, an issue of balancing your mission, your responsibility, as well as the responsibility that you have for the people that work with you directly or indirectly.
Yeah, that's a good mindset. I like that. Your brain, and you're from the brain expert, says that your brain needs to be shaken up and changed, and that is healthy. What's the latest in Congress as far as changing the name of NIDA from National Institute on Drug Abuse to Drug Agency?
You know, I think that's probably at the end of their list.
Okay.
Now they are focusing on so many other things than a name. They say, what is the consequential of names? Not understanding why it is important in terms of shifting a culture of stigmatization. But I suspect that it's at the end of the list.
Yeah.
I hope I'm wrong. You know, I'd love to change our name because abuse and drug abuse. I mean, the National Institute of Drug Abuse. I mean, and the abuse word is so negatively conditioned, but that's outside of my realm and there's so much I can do there.
Yeah. I was just wondering, because I know that we've talked about that for several years and we know, you know, one of the things that moving Congress is not easy. But I know that was something that you wanted to do for the agency. But speaking of name,
I want to do.
Yeah, you wanted to do that. Yeah, yeah.
What is the bandwidth and what makes the most sense for me to put my effort to? I put a lot of effort into the name. I have a big series of other priorities right now, which I am diverting my attention to. So it's not that I don't care at all. I care very much. But it's, again, the issue of how do I make decisions of how to optimally utilize the bandwidth that we have.
Right. But you know, what's in a name? Sometimes language is important, but probably the end result of the language is what's the most important. And you mentioned that. One of the things that you said that you're proudest is really the stigma, the culture change has changed. And whether you call it abuse or agency, I think we have moved a lot in the issue of stigma towards addiction. Maybe not perfect, but we really have moved it a lot in the right direction. And I would also say, get your input on this, maybe parts of our society have gone a little too far where they are normalizing drug use and saying that it's okay to use drugs because the stigma went away from the person to also to the drug. And I think we've talked about this before, that stigma should be still attached to the drugs. We don't want people using fentanyl illegally. But if somebody has a problem, we want to offer compassionate care.
Yeah, and we've discussed this because certainly it is clear that using drugs can have very negative consequences. So, and in public health, you want to actually provide guidelines that protect the population. But you also need to understand that when we speak to sort of status statement, you shouldn't be taking drugs. We have to understand it on the context of the individual. And this was brought to my attention. I was in a meeting where I was surrounded of people that were taking drugs. And I was, of course, saying, well, what we're aiming for in recovery ultimately is the ability not to have that need for the drug. And there was this young man that stood up and says, you know, I'm going to tell you my story so that you can get a different perspective on how sometimes it's not so simple. And this was a young man that had been brought up and apparently sexually abused by both his father and mother and during his childhood and adolescence. And he said, the only reason why I'm alive is because of cocaine, because cocaine gave me a means of escaping. And so what the point is that there are certain circumstances where people don't have any alternatives. And when that drug use can offer at least a respite from a situation that otherwise is untenable. So understanding that the circumstances are not always the same is crucial to keep in mind. So when we basically aim to send these messages, you want to ultimately prevent people from taking drugs because they are so negative at many levels. And if you have a respite, it's just temporarily, then you will feel worse. We need to also consider what is it intervention that we're going to be giving aside that messaging so that that individual that finds themselves in those circumstances can have hope for alternatives. Because otherwise, our messaging can go all the way it can. It could go in deaf ears.
I have to think about that one a little bit because we still want to create an America that message is not universal. There's an exception to the gentleman who gave that example that you just did that shared with you. You still don't want him to use cocaine, right? You still don't. You still want him to seek recovery. You just don't want to judge him about why he made the decision to use drugs. So I instead of saying, well, some people, drugs help them because they have a respite from whatever problems.
Temporary respite.
Right. We don't want that. We want to teach resilient skills at a young age and to adulthood that helps you deal with life's adversities because life is not easy, but that you can have a toolkit to use when life is hard that doesn't include drugs.
Absolutely. And I think that you are exactly on target. And this is an aspect of we're very, very invested on how do we basically implement those prevention interventions that showed exactly that empowering and training young people on skills that can help them navigate the peer pressure of taking drugs. But that, again, one of the issues that we face is that while the evidence is out there of multiple interventions that work, they're not being deployed. So that, and that's why I was very explicit on stating, if we send this message at the same time, because otherwise it's hypocritical, we need to provide with the resources and the structure that will help that individual follow our advice.
Yes. Yes, of course. Right. That person who took the wrong turn needs to be able to help to get back. Let's talk mortality data. That seems to be like, you know, the top of the iceberg of the problem. The CDC mortality data is showing a decline in fentanyl deaths. What are you?
It's great.
Yeah, it's good news. What are your thoughts as to the reasons?
Well, it's going to be speculative, but I think it is wonderful news. I think that this is not just error on the measurements. I think that these are very real numbers that indicate a decline. And I've been looking specifically actually on the overdoses from the different drugs, and you see it across all of the drugs. The largest reduction is on fentanyl, but you also see reductions with methadone, with prescription opioids, with cocaine, with methamphetamine. So what is driving this decrease in mortality? Well, I think that it's likely to be two main factors. One of them relates to widespread access and acceptance of therapeutics for overdose reversal, dissemination and the actually accessibility of naloxone and education of the public of how to use it and its safety, particularly bringing it to the places where you're more likely to encounter people with overdoses is likely to have saved many lives. I mean, it's you as a physician know how effective naloxone is. You just need to administer it at the correct dose, at the proper time. And that makes, if you do it, you're saving a life. Similarly, I think that there had been perhaps pushed very much by the COVID pandemic shifts in the willingness to be more open on accessing treatment medications for opioid use disorder that has made it easier for patients to have access to either methadone or buprenorphine. And that in turn has made it also easier for them to stay in treatment because you can have prevent overdoses from methadone and from buprenorphine, provided that you take it. And these changes that the COVID pandemic actually triggered have made it easier for patients to stay in treatment. So those are two important factors. However, I also think that another element that may be playing a role, and we don't know yet, we're actually trying to gather data, is that of shifts in the illicit drug market. So there, some of the drug seizures are describing that the fentanyl that they are encountering is of lower purity. So if it's lower purity, you're consuming lower doses, and that decreases its risk. Others basically are describing, for example, you know, during the COVID pandemic, a very important way of getting fentanyl into our country was to illicitly manufacture prescription pills, which contain fentanyl. Well, the percentage of those illicitly manufactured pills that contain fentanyl is going down, according to the DEA. So there are those two factors playing around. One of them is from the perspective of access to treatments. And again, education and knowledge. I was flabbergasted when I would get people. I basically do travel a lot, and I go to rural communities or to other cities in other states. And I was flabbergasted that people didn't know about fentanyl. This happened to me like 6 years ago. I was at West Virginia, which is at the epicenter of the pandemic and there. So people, what is fentanyl? So that is not the case right now. Everybody's aware. And as a result of that, there's much more caution. So these are likely to be important factors that are actually driving decreases.
Yeah.
I do think that it's important that we go from me speculating to actually getting the data so that we understand, because if we understand it, then we can emulate it. And I do want to make another point, because I think it is extremely crucial in the dynamics and answering your question, is yes, this is an average of 14% decline in 1 year, 14% decline on overall overdose mortality is huge, but it's not across all groups. So we are not seeing a decrease in the mortality among Black Americans, and we're not seeing a decrease in mortality among Native American, Alaska Natives. These two groups have the highest rates of mortality. So the question is why? And one possibility, I mean, obviously, that comes into mind is that the access to the therapeutics that have protected others from dying may not be as widespreadly accessible to them than for other groups. That's one possibility. Whether they have different access to different types of illicit drugs, that is unclear to me. I do not know of specifically on any data that would provide support to that contention, but we have to evaluate why there are these differences among demographics.
Yeah, so you're giving credit really to the supply side as well as the demand side of the equation. I was kind of looking at, and disagree with me because I'm just kind of bouncing my thoughts of looking at that. In San Diego, our decline is even higher, like 38% less from fentanyl and less for all drugs. And I think the all drugs make sense to me because there's so much fentanyl in the cocaine, fentanyl in the meth, fentanyl in the pills, et cetera. So if there's less total fentanyl, then all the drugs will be affected. But when I look at the data, you have the mortality going down, but the other graph, non-fatal events, number of naloxone required, that stayed steady. And I'm not the epidemiologist, but to me that means a supply issue, right? That it is less potent, like the DEA, you know, potency in the pills said, and that the price of fentanyl has gone up, meaning so it's diluted more and then its potency goes down. That doesn't explain why we have the subset of populations that are at risk that haven't seen the decline as much as other populations. But I think, I think the supply has a lot to do with it as well. Not that naloxone, of course, saves lives. Not just one life. Sometimes it's 10 lives in one person. And of course, treatment helps people reach recovery.
Yeah, no, and I that's why I say it's likely that those two factors are playing a role. And we are monitoring from wastewater the content of fentanyl in the wastewater, and it does appear to be going down. Now, if you see a decreasing content of fentanyl in the wastewater, it could mean two things. One of them, there's less fentanyl available in the illicit drug market, or there are less people taking the fentanyl, and therefore it doesn't get into the wastewater, which also could reflect the fact that we're keeping people that are highest risk for overdosing and consuming fentanyl in treatment longer, and so we are preventing them from them actually consuming the drug. So those two elements are likely to be playing a role. And we're starting to actually ask for those sites that have information from wastewater, how does the content of naloxone, has it shifted during this time period? Again, it's too preliminary. I don't feel comfortable enough to actually describe the results that we've got, but that is another aspect, another set of data that we have to try to understand.
Are you measuring naloxone in the water too, or just the fentanyl in the water?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. That will be interesting.
Measure anything you want.
I talked to a group recently who really wants to see like a national dashboard and benchmarking for this problem. So one dashboard measure that we always talk about is mortality. And again, and that it makes sense because death is the tip of the iceberg, and you can't really argue with that. Although some people argue with anything, but in general, do you think mortality is the best dashboard point, or should we add to that number in treatment, number of schools offering prevention, number of people in recovery, like other parts of the dashboard? What do you think?
I think that we should have more elements in our dashboard, but absolutely mortality is a crucial one. And the beauty of mortality is that everybody understands and resonates with it. And as you know, as your surveys become longer, the likelihood of completing them goes down. So I think that people try to come up with simplified lists. But I do think that if we want to actually monitor advances and outcomes, we need to have more granularity than just mortality. And you were sort of stating in terms of a number of people in treatment, and they are. We follow them. There are surveys that are following them. How accurate they are, I do not know. That's another aspect in terms of number of prevention programs. We know that we can do much more. They are very, very limited. And identifying where the larger gap areas allows us to then try to see exactly why is it that there is such a difference in what we should be doing and what we have, and hopefully one intervene. So yes, I do think that we have to expand our dashboard beyond just mortality, but I do believe strongly that we need to keep our eyes very carefully on
the mortality. Line one is still mortality.
Oh, yeah, no, it's key. And it moves and it has been very effective.
Yeah.
What do you think? There are, you know, definitely a lot of parents who've lost their children to fentanyl and they object to the word overdose and they want to be said, my child didn't overdose, they were poisoned. Does that language, we kind of talked about how we want to call things, language matters in some ways. Has that language entered the NIDA world on poisoning?
Certainly it has. I mean, it emerges because there are some parents or family members that says, well, you know, my kid never took drugs and he just took this pill, went to sleep and never woke up. And in that case, you can say, well, I mean, this was a poison that died of an overdose. So it is, again, in terms of how do we communicate it in such a way that it is not, I mean, and again, it also presumes that discrimination. So if I die by poisoning, it's less blaming than if I die by an overdose because I was taking the drugs. So underlying this discussion, there is, as you can see, the stigma related to something that is seen as volitional when in fact it's not, that leads people to actually be sensitive to it. And the way that I deal with it is because, of course, I'm respectful of parents who, at this point, I'm losing a child. I cannot imagine what it is. And so being respectful to their suffering and describing the process in a way that is not going to make them cringe. But at the same time, being objective and medically, you can say this person consume a dose that was basically presumably by accident that resulted in an overdose. And that's what basically that led to their death. So that is just being more descriptive.
Yeah. Research wishes, like NIDA is, you know, the lead research agencies. The one research question is, I've talked to you this about this, and I'm frustrated that we don't have this data that we should by now, is we know the people who died, but we don't know, you know, we know all these people died of fentanyl. We don't know that that was their intention. But we could get that data if we simply asked everybody who overdosed, every patient who came in the emergency department, what did you intend to use? Now, I do that as a clinician. Every overdose, what did you think you take? Because it's important because if they have an opiate use disorder, I'm going to connect them to treatment. But what I find is for all the patients that I, you know, overdosed, and I call them naloxone wake up, many of them don't qualify to get MAT because that's not was their intention. But we should have that data. And if you could activate your emergency department connection groups, I think that that's a fairly simple thing to ask. And it would direct our treatment, right? Like, you know, so a patient woke up and they, you know, this is not my intention. That's not what happened. They used cocaine. Then they don't need Suboxone. They need fentanyl testing strips, you know, for their cocaine.
All right.
Or... Yeah, no, I like the suggestion. I guess that the sense is in general, as clinicians, sometimes the question is asked directly, were you intending to harm yourself? And so if you have a suicidal thinking, that's one thing. But on the other hand, if you really don't care and you sort of says, no, I really didn't intend to kill myself. I just don't care if I live or die. I mean, that is basically passive suicidal thinking. But by asking them what was the drug that you were intending to take, you can get an insight of, in fact, is this was completely unintentional or whether there could be intentional components to it, which you need to address. And whether even if with passive, I mean, when someone is passively telling you, you know, I don't care. I mean, ultimately, I need to get high, and if I die, I die. But otherwise, that's fine. We need to intervene so that they start to care about being alive.
Right. But suicide, that is different. That is another completely, we could devote a whole podcast to, or more to that. I'm talking about people who come in with a naloxone wake up who did not mean to die. They took a drug and almost died, but they were saved with naloxone. Now, what was their intention, right? Because we want to provide treatment, but not everybody intended to take fentanyl, so they need different interventions, right?
Correct. Yeah, no, and that, and when you have that, and sort of say, oh, I took a sleeping pill that my friend gave to me, or I bought pain medications, because then it's relatively easy to follow. I was interpreting it to try to go a little bit more to engage into the understanding about why people who are addicted to drugs are basically driving such risky behaviors, because we need to address them. Otherwise, they are going to continue to come back again and again and again.
Right.
But I think we should have that data, because then we'd be better at our intervention. So, for example, here's a simple example. I worked last year, New Year's, and there was some big rave concert at our Padre Stadium, and ambulances were just bringing the patients one by one, and these were not our homeless San Diego populations. They were like, you know, wealthy people with an American Express gold card from Chicago went to this concert, and they were overdosing on fentanyl and multiple other drugs that they intended to use drugs, but like the one guy I talked to, he had a seizure. And when he woke up, I asked, you know, do you want to find out what happened, what you took? And he goes, yeah, he was just, you know, spreading, you know, passing a little, whatever, joint, what looked like a joint. So he took that too. But he almost died of fentanyl. And he had no idea. But that intervention, I went back to the county of San Diego saying, if we're going to have parties like this, we should have drug tracking programs at the party so people know what they're using.
As you know, there are movements toward doing that, actually, to provide with strips and testing mechanisms so that they know what they are taking. And in that case, it was an easy one, because you have a cluster of cases coming from the same place. And as you say, they don't look like a person that has been struggling with drugs and has been in the street. So you can surmise that this was an aspect where the drugs were contaminated with fentanyl. But in other instances, it's not so simple and straightforward. And in demographics, you see older people coming with an overdose, and they don't have per se a prescription to themselves, and they've overdosed. So, and the same thing with teenagers, as you know, and they overdose, and they are not taking heroin or cocaine or anything. They just wanted to have fun on a party. So understanding the context. But what you are saying, though, what you are, I think, putting into my brain is the concept of creating a questionnaire that actually allows us with common data elements to identify in a systematic fashion in the emergency department the cases that you are observing. What percentage of them reflect cases where the drugs that they were using were contaminated with fentanyl as opposed to others? That we can look into determine what we can do with that, because there is an emergency department network of academic centers. Yeah. And that should not be very complicated to actually to obtain, in principle, theoretically.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I do this. That's how I get this idea. So all the patients who overdose, I ask them. Well, I'm also curious. I want to find out about their journey into drugs, motivation, in order to connect them with the right treatment. And we have all the treatment. We want to keep people into MAT, but I'm finding that they don't fit that one pathway that we have for them. They need different pathways, right? And the other question that I ask is, what's the first drug you ever used? And I realize that that's not even the right way to ask, because they'll say, oh, you know, I started using meth when I was 20. I said, no, when did you start using weed? Because they don't think that marijuana is a drug. And they'll say, oh, weed? Oh, I did that when I was 9, very young. And I would say, for my non-data, but I mean, something that I would love to know if that's true, because it changed over time. It used to be people who were using heroin, you know, whatever, a good percentage of them started out with opioid pills from prescriptions. But I would say now, my anecdotal evidence is 9 out of 10 started with marijuana at a very young age.
Yeah, and Ronette, that is known by epidemiological studies, and that's what gave the name of marijuana as a gateway drug.
Yeah.
Epidemiological studies were showing that people that were ending up with cocaine or with methamphetamine or heroin use disorders got initiated with marijuana. And so the concept was marijuana as a gateway drug. And researchers have been trying to understand, is it a gateway drug because exposure to marijuana when your brain is developing changes its physiology? And there is data from animal experiments that shows that indeed, if you expose, this is done in rats, but if you expose rats in very young age, equivalent to adolescence in adults, to THC, the active ingredient of marijuana, then the reactivity of the dopamine reward system is attenuated. So it becomes hypofunctional. And then these animals then more vulnerable to escalate into drug taking. Does that same thing happen in humans? Per se is unclear. I mean, and a counter argument in all of this, because we also know that if you look at epidemiological data objectively, you also see that most cases, even more than marijuana, the first drugs that teenagers get exposed to is alcohol. And so you can then say, is alcohol like a gateway drug? And in the past, it was nicotine. Is nicotine a gateway drug? And animal experiments also indicate that these drugs early on in development can produce changes that can then affect the sensitivity to the rewarding effects of drugs. So there is, from the perspective of pharmacology, evidence to indicate that it could be, but also importantly, the notion of what drugs you encounter. If you're a teenager, it's much easier these days to encounter marijuana because it's everywhere than other drugs. It's actually even more easier to get alcohol than even marijuana. So yes, by probability, if you're a risk taker, if you're a peer engaging and like adventure and don't sort of like the excitement, you'll take the drug that's in front of you. So that is also the issue of accessibility as a teenager.
Right. That's true. That's very important. And same mechanism, whether it's alcohol, nicotine, or marijuana, or whatever, or pills, it's that dopamine downregulation that and that cycle that leads you to using more drugs.
Correct. And some people are more or less sensitive, of course.
Yeah. Let's talk about prevention. NIDA is working on all sorts of things, including prevention, you know, enhancing protective factors, decreasing the risk factors that lead to drug use. I'm wondering if you're involved in any of the, there's many programs that are promoted through prevention science specialists that offer training at school. In school programs, and that have shown that, you know, schools that have had this kind of life skills or various training down the line have less drug use, but also higher academic achievement, less bullying, less violent, all sorts of things. And I don't know if that's one of the things that you're involved in, but my ideal would be to have some type of program like this in every school and homeschool in the United States.
Yes, we are involved with them. We fund the researchers, many of them who have developed these programs to actually build the evidence. But it's exactly programs like that have been shown that actually not only improves their education and their overall protection against using drugs, but what some of these studies have shown is that if the intervention is done, you tend to do it when they are teenagers or late childhood, then they follow them and they can see the beneficial effects on the children of these children. So it has a transgenerational positive effect. And they've looked at it at multiple indicators. And one of them actually that I find very interesting because we're so very, very much involved in trying to understand why adverse childhood experiences or socioeconomical determinants of health so negatively increase your risk for taking drugs and becoming addicted. So out of these studies, what these prevention investigators are starting to show is some of these interventions actually mitigate the negative effects of socioeconomical deprivation on the development of the brain. So not being exposed to high-level education, to the presence of your parents because they have to get two jobs at the same time because you actually don't, no one is observing whether you're doing your homework or not, or you go to bed or not, or you eat proper nutrition. Socioeconomics, low socioeconomics, negatively impacts the development of your brain. And that actually is mitigated, has been shown to be mitigated by some of the these prevention programs. So they work, but they are not being implemented. So what we're doing right now, Ronette, and be attentive to it, we ask the National Academy of Sciences and Medicine to do a report and analysis of the science of prevention and try to understand what are gap areas. But importantly, to identify what are the factors that have interfered with the implementation of those evidence-based prevention interventions. And the third thing that we tasked the National Academy to do is to look at, are there policies that could be proposed that could sustain and support the implementation of these evidence-based prevention efforts. So yes, we're trying to understand it's not an issue necessarily of lack of evidence, but overall that these programs work, they work, is the whole concept about why are they not implemented?
Yeah, well, I think we need the right incentives, right, to make sure that they're there.
Yeah. How do you do that? That's why the issue of the policy, we staff them specifically. We don't want academic recommendations overall. We want things that we can bite into that can drive and change the ability to provide these prevention efforts across the country and sustain them. So actionable recommendations,
yeah.
But academic or ethical.
I am hopeful now with Bobby Kennedy as head of HHS. His focus seems to be, and I just know what I read in the newspaper. I don't have any inside knowledge, but that his effort seems to be towards prevention, right? Prevention of chronic disease, you know, not just treating the sickness, but also preventing it. And he probably does, I don't know if he has addiction in mind, but it follows that same principle. We can, you know, spell all our effort on treating addiction, and we need to, just like we're treating diabetes and cancer, but we should be investing in the front end to, so we have less of this problem. I feel like that flows, and I hope anybody has an opportunity to talk to him and convince him of that.
Well, I'm sure that I sort of, obviously, I also resonate with his focusing on the importance of prevention because it's a non-brainer. I mean, prevention saves you an enormous amount of money, but it doesn't attract the attention that a therapeutic intervention does. And certainly in chronic diseases, as he speaks about the importance and the burden that it has for the health of our country and the mortality, addiction is a major contributor. So chronic diseases are much more severe, much more prevalent, and much more comorbid in people with substance use disorder. And this is not just aleatory. There's a reason why this is happening. So I don't see how an initiative that targets chronic diseases is going to be able to avoid substance use disorders, because they are really a key component involved with it. And the other aspect that it shares with many of these other chronic conditions is that in a very tragic way, many of them are driven by commercial interests. And so, like, for example, the easier one to see is obesity and diabetes. Commercial interest of an industry that pushes foods that are obesogenic, as opposed to incentivizing an industry that actually makes healthy meals affordable and appealing. So that is a prevention intervention. But in drugs, it's the same thing. What drives that drug is the business of the people that are making extremely large amounts of money with drugs, whether it is legal, illegal, both of them. There are tremendous commercial interests. So targeting these elements is common to this condition. So I would hope that he's going to be sensitive around it. That I don't know him neither. I read what I read, like you.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I think they've got a mandate to get it done. So I hope it really happens.
I mean, again, we don't have this ability to read the future, but I absolutely resonate on the importance of tackling chronic disease in our country, and I resonate on how crucial it is that we pay more attention to prevention and that we build a prevention infrastructure. Ronette, think about it. We have the healthcare system to provide treatment. What do we have really to provide prevention? What do we have as a system to provide prevention for substance use disorders? We would want the educational system, the healthcare system. Those are structures that we have. but we don't use them for this. So
we need that. Yeah, absolutely. In the schools and in the home, the only thing that we have is, you know, the CADCA, drug-free communities, which is important, but that's it. That's all we have. Nothing else. Yeah,
I agree.
And permeating the healthcare system, I think that is another important opportunity, because children and teenagers, whether it is because they have to go to the dentist or because they have to go to their physical checkups, or they get they fall and they have a fracture, they get engaged with the healthcare system. So it's an opportunity that we have to intervene, and that we're not taking advantage of it.
I agree. One of the things that I do in my lectures is when I talk to doctors, is I'll say, you know, you always ask everyone, do you smoke, drink, or use drugs? But if you see a child and they say no, then say, good job, you're protecting your brain. You just spent how long did that take me? Like 2 seconds, and you could have changed that child's life and feel good. You want to reinforce that at young ages. And it doesn't take that long to make that impactful message from a doctor. Yeah.
No, I agree. I agree totally. Or from a dentist or someone that you...
Yeah. Good job. Good for you.
Your coach. I mean, there are many people that are very influential in young people's lives.
Treatment. Okay. What is the latest, hottest, bestest thing that you're excited about in terms of addiction treatment?
The easiest one that jumps into my brain is the GLP-1 medications, the glucagon-like peptides, the Ozempic.
The Ozempic? In order to lose weight and stop drugs, is a magical pill all in one?
Well, it goes beyond that. You know, there's this interest about being preventive for Parkinson's disease, and that it improves your cardiovascular risk, that it basically prevents on dementia. So when you start to see all of these incredibly exciting things, this sounds like a magical drug. And when you hear about magical drugs, I tend to say, be careful, we've been there before. But if you look at why I am basically excited about it, and I'm overall, and I think it is telling us something, if indeed this crystallizes in telling us a story that can be replicated. We have been funding research with these drugs in the substance, in preclinical models. And what these drugs do, in whether it's cocaine, nicotine, alcohol, or heroin, you know, all of the drugs of abuse produce addiction because they can activate the dopamine reward system. When you give these medications to rats and you give them then the drug, again, cocaine or nicotine, whatever you want, that response, dopaminergic response, is significantly attenuated. In other words, when you are under these medications and you take these drugs are going to be less rewarding. And ergo, because it is the dopamine signaling that triggers neuroplasticity, you are decreasing the likelihood of them become addicted to them. That's one element to it.
Is it, or if you're used to using the drug, if you're used to, let's say, you're using cocaine, but now you're using Ozempic, so now you have less of an effect of cocaine. Wouldn't it then, if you're really hungry for it, want to use more cocaine and more chances of overdosing?
No, because you feel basically, there is a very interesting phenomenon that happens with drugs and with food. I mean, so when you eat, and if you just try to see your own experiences, I mean, there is this, you may have hunger or not, do it the first 2 or 3 bites. And then there is that, like, this energized hunger that leads you to want to eat more. And that is likely to be physiologically, evolutionary necessary for you to eat sufficient calories when you are sitting down to eat. And so you actually drive. It's almost like a triggering or an effect. Normally, you eat a certain amount of calories and then you stop. You feel satiated. When you become a compulsive eater, or when you become a compulsive drug taker because you have addiction, you don't have that satiety response. And that is one of the circuits that actually is reset back by GLP drugs. So this is one of the speculations regarding of why it works. The circuit that signals internal sense of satiety that you've had enough, it disrupted both in obesity and in addiction, and these medications can reset it. So it's not just about the fact that if you're going to first take it, you're less likely to become addicted. That's correct. But on the other hand, if you already are addicted to it and you take these medications, and this is what patients are saying, that's what attracted the attention. They started to say, you know, it's strange, I don't feel like drinking anymore.
Interesting. And it works for everything. It works for tobacco, for alcohol, for drugs. And is this FDA approved or not?
No, it's not the FDA approved. I mean, you're asking me when I'm excited. So I'm excited on doing the randomized clinical trials that will be able to determine, is it really a mirage or is it effective? Now, if it is effective and it shows that it actually significantly reduces drug taking, and in fact, there's already a randomized clinical trial done by, at the University of Pennsylvania for alcohol that shows that semaglutide, which is Wegovy, was basically effective in reducing the drinking in people with an alcohol use disorder. The number of heavy drinking days was reduced by the medication. So that there's already, and it's a completely randomized clinical trial. It has to be replicated, of course, and we're similarly starting studies to evaluate this type of medications, the second generation glucagon-like peptide medications for stimulant use disorder and for opioid use disorder.
Wow, that's interesting. And then, of course, you connected me years ago with a company, Clear Scientific, that's working on this. I wouldn't call it treatment, it's a rescue drug, right? That clears methamphetamine, fentanyl, and cocaine, in case of a sudden overdose, in the emergency room, clears it out of your system within minutes of deactivating. So they're now, I think, in phase two. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, no, they're testing it both for fentanyl and methamphetamine. So it's a capturing drug. It's a sequester.
Yeah. So we talked about prevention, treatment. I need to ask you about harm reduction. Do we have a universal definition for harm reduction? Because sometimes I see it used, in the strictest definition, and sometimes I see it being used for social justice or things that are a little softer.
Well, I guess that the harm reduction is practices that are aimed to keeping a person alive, even if you don't necessarily target the abstinence from taking the drug. So how do you actually ensure that a person does not die or end up with very negative adverse consequences from their drug use? And that gives you the flexibility of going beyond what we traditionally see as harm reduction practices, such as naloxone or syringe exchange programs. My view is that I come to realize, having been at NIDA for 21 years, that we can learn a lot from people that are taking drugs and to try to learn from them what are the practices that they may be using to actually protect themselves from dying. And it's in that, and it behooves us to then do the studies to determine if there is evidence of what they are doing, as opposed to just dismissing it. That is, so keeping that in mind, a way of keeping people who are taking drugs and are not ready to actually go to treatment alive, or minimize the likelihood that they end up with HIV or hepatitis C, is the definition that I would favor, because it gives us flexibility to incorporate novel interventions that we don't think about.
Right. So the definition is to reduce harm from a disease, right, when you can't completely treat it, if we're not at that. I agree with that definition. And hopefully it'll be more and more evidence-based. So there's always so many things I could talk to you about, but we're running out of time. What is your final public health message that you'll like to bring to us for 2025?
Well, I think that you actually voiced it already in the question that you were saying, that for 2025, we cannot absolutely ignore how devastating drugs can be to an individual and to a society. Because you were asking me, well, what are the outcomes that we should be looking? Should we expand the questionnaire? How many people are dying? But it's not just that. I mean, drugs also undermine the socioeconomic structure of a nation. And I've always said that if you want to basically debilitate a country, get drugs into it, destabilize it. And so whether you're looking at it from the perspective of policy, public health, you also need to recognize what it is for us as a nation to ensure that we have a future with the greatest likelihood of success. And that requires that we pay attention to interventions to prevent and treat substance use disorders, which will absolutely require that we provide alternatives to people that in many instances have none. So it's not, we have to realize that it does require active engagement and involvement in policies and practices that that change the structure so that individuals are given opportunities, and that we also in the process remove stigma and discrimination, which again are one of the factors that contributes continuously to the tremendous despair that people feel, the isolation, the loneliness. We need to target that.
That's great. Great message. That's why you're the rock star, Nora. Thank you so much. And may you have a wonderful 2025 and all your goals be fulfilled.
Likewise, all of our goals, we're here in a common goal. We want to improve the health and the well-being of everyone.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.